All right, Todd can do it, I'm sure. He's got a time slide.
I think the point is that
I can understand.
Tell him about the surgery.
Oh, yeah. I can do that. I'll start real quick with Todd. But anyway, the second talk was Sydney was trying to get my former business partner, Tim Hazlett, to do this talk, and I'm just going to leave it there because I want to show that last slide off to my other talk real quick. But Tim and I started Hazlett Kincaid in 1997. He did his undergraduate work at Rensselaer Polytechnic, and then from there went to Missouri, and then on to Johns Hopkins to do a PhD in groundwater modeling. And when he finished, we joined together to form Hazlett Kincaid. He came down and opened our office in Florida, and actually part of this talk that I'm going to present for him was a very small part in this case because I'm doing it, but if Tim were doing it, he would talk more about the model that he did for the Schmitz related to the corkscrew mine. We'll talk a little bit on that. So we've worked together for 8 years to do hydrogeological assessments where largely what I was focused on was doing the conceptual models, building the conceptualization of the system, and then Tim would focus on doing the groundwater modeling. As I was said earlier, Tim and I parted ways last year. Amicably, he went to Aardman Associates in Orlando, and unfortunately he couldn't make it here today because he's recovering from a recent back surgery. So he is in Orlando trying to recover from that, but I'm told that he is likely to make a full recovery and that should work out well. So, but anyway, if you don't mind and bear with me, I will fill in for Tim as much as I can, and I changed the talk around a bit to so that I didn't have to talk about things I didn't know about. But I have two slides on the last talk that are going to become pertinent on the next talk, and they really relate to the concept of karst, of where is karst. And karst is not, it's really defined by where there is soluble rock. And these are some pictures from a model that I'm going to show you a little bit in the next talk from Hercules Quarry in Pennsylvania. It's in Stockertown, Pennsylvania. This is a big limestone quarry. They're dewatering the quarry here for cement rock. And here you can see this big waterfall. I don't know if you can make it out. It's coming out of the limestone wall there, but this is a karst setting. Water's pouring out of this wall through what is in essence now a spring. It was a conduit that was intercepted when they quarried down through the lime rock. And now what they have to do is they pump the water that comes into the quarry up and out and into a creek, which flows downstream. So these karst features, you're going to find this kind of karst and karst features anywhere that there is soluble rock. And the last one that I've got, I think, was really neat because, I often hear that there's no karst in South Florida. There's no karst in my county. Okay, so
I'm going to what our miners are saying.
Pick on the USGS a little bit there. Sorry about that, but and actually, Alan Shapiro, in his defense, was trying to do, he believed that there were karst features down there and that the powers that be wouldn't let him do the test the right way. But in essence, we're talking about Miami-Dade County, northern Miami-Dade, Wellfield. There's quarries, we've heard, that are located not very far away from that Wellfield. The conventional wisdom, or the models, the numerical groundwater models that were based largely on the porous media type of theory, showed that the groundwater travel times were very slow, that it would take many days, many tens of days, for water to travel from the quarries to the well field. So I'm not super familiar with exactly how it ended up happening, but ultimately the USGS was asked to do a dye tracer study where they injected, I believe it was like 200 kilograms of rhodamine dye into a well about a hundred or a few hundred feet away from the Miami-Dade well field wells. Well, that's a lot of dye, let me tell you that. Dye goes a long way, especially in karst, through conduits. Well, they the powers that be were insistent that, that Alan put in, you know, the whole thing all at once instead of doing a stepped test, and because they knew that this model was correct and that it was going to, you know, this was a formality and just get this over with, move on. Well, the problem was is that the dye showed up at the wells, but it showed up in 4 hours instead of 10 days or whatever it was that they thought it was going to take. And it showed up when it travels very fast, it doesn't dilute. And because it didn't dilute, it when it entered those municipal supply wells are not set up to filter out dye. They're not, they don't have carbon filtration systems. So that dye just passed straight through to the end users and turned people's laundry pink. So they call it, now they call it, I like it, they call it the pink underwear test. So Alan invited me to come up and talk to his group 2 years ago, and I couldn't resist. You know, that was kind of my first line. I was like, Alan, how did that pink underwear test turn out? Yeah.
We saw that news article when it came out, and they in Miami, they notified 100,000 people not to launder their clothes because
it's going to turn pink. But then it's safe to drink.
Yeah, well, it is safe. In fairness, it is safe to drink. You're just going to turn your innards red.
That article was only online for 2 days, but it was taken down, and you couldn't find it anymore.
Yeah. Well, as a dye tracer, I can tell you that, generally speaking, you try to design tests not to turn people's underwear pink. Because, really, you try to be incognito. That's not a good way to stay incognito. So, I just wanted to show you those because I'm going to make reference to the Hercules glory on this talk. But here, basically, what I'm going to do is talk about modeling, and also try to draw it together to some conclusions about, you know, this problem that, you know, of mining as a more of a larger scale problem. But I was working in Pennsylvania, and I ran across a quote from another dye tracing consultant, actually, that said limestone areas are a bad place for lime rock quartz. And I mean, it's like, okay, his deal was that, well, there's these conduits and you get these conduit flow and the quarries intersect these things and they're hard to deal with. And you're like, well, yeah, but if you need limestone, it's pretty hard to get it anywhere but from lime rock areas. So, you know, that's just one of the things you're going to have to live with. So really, the way I look at it is, it kind of, you can turn this problem a little bit around. And If we, and apparently we don't necessarily all agree, but if we accept that we need quarry products, then the challenge is to locate them, manage them such that the environmental impacts are minimized and repaired to every extent possible after the quarry closes. In my opinion, as a consultant, to me, that's my job, is to say, where's the best place to put these things? And what is the best way to, you know, how can I help you do it in such a way that it is okay? That would be the goal. Impact is the problem, and here's where I think I've seen a lot of people say the same things, so it won't be any different, but impact assessments are often obscure and non-accessible. So the idea that things get done behind closed doors doesn't seem to me to be a good way to go about that. Accomplishing this goal. And my goal here is going to be to describe how modeling fits into that process and describe how I think it should basically fit into that process. Actually, that'd be really good. Thank you. Well, first of all, what are groundwater models? I think I assume that many people know what they are when they probably don't. But groundwater models are tools that are most often used to make predictions about future impacts to groundwater resources associated with proposed activities or existing problems. And that's really the key, the predictions. They can be analytical, meaning that they're mathematical, basically write a mathematical equation and solve it. They can be stochastic, meaning that they just look at it from a statistical point of view. They can be numerical, meaning that you use a computer to iterate through solving techniques to arrive about an answer. Or they can be some combination of the three of those. And here's where they fit in, really, is that they fit in because they're quite often required by state and or federal regulatory agencies for impact and contamination assessments specifically because of their ability to predict the future. And so this is why they're often required, and it's also why they're often problematic. Because people tend to expect the answer. You know, the idea is like, well, we're going to run this groundwater model, and it's going to tell us what the answer is. You're like, no, it isn't going to tell you what the answer is. It's going to tell you one realization of a potential. And so the real way that a groundwater model should be used is as a tool to educate yourself, to run many different types of simulations under different types of conditions and see what is possible, what is likely, and educate yourself about the process of groundwater flow and contamination or impacts at any particular site, using that as a tool. The problem is that most of these models are often based on the simplifying assumptions that render the resulting predictions dangerously inaccurate, particularly when applied to karst aquifers. And that's that part I said where they have the four pages of, you know, well, we got conduits and we got this and we did fracture traces and da 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 da. And then for modeling purposes, we're going to assume that it's isotropic homogeneous media and then turn it to the next page. So really what you end up with is a model that needs to be of this, and it really is of this. And the two aren't the same, and so you're not going to get the right kind of answer. So I borrowed these slides from a colleague of mine who works on these same kind of problems in Germany, Martin Stoddard. And he's also a professor, and professors make really good slides of teaching things, so it was nice of him to lend those to me. But basically, the problem in groundwater and groundwater modeling is we have to model that type of porosity that characterizes the karst aquifer. Really, it boils down to this one, which is a combination of three types of porosities. You have, particularly in Florida, you have the matrix or the rock itself that is highly permeable. And that's why it's been so hard to get people to accept that karst is present. Because if you look at the karst aquifers around the world, they're most often characterized by the fact that if you put a well in the aquifer and you hit a conduit, for instance in Tennessee, then you get a lot of water. And if you put a conduit in the same aquifer, or if you put a well in the same aquifer and you don't hit a conduit, you won't get any water. So, but then when those same drillers or those same scientists come to Florida, they put a well anywhere they want, they get lots of water, they say, well, this can't be karst. Because Tennessee is karst, we can walk through those caves. How many people have been to Mammoth Cave? Anybody? A couple people. So that's obvious, but here you have to swim through them, and not very many people are swimming through them. So if you can put a well anywhere here and get lots of water, but in there you have to hit the conduit in order to get water, then how can these aquifers be the same? And really they're the same because the conduits are the same, but the matrix permeability is different. And so here, if you put a well anywhere, what you're doing is you're sucking water out of that closest conduit away. And so your model has to be able to accommodate for that. So in model, kind of simplified model space, if you assume that the aquifer is isotropic and homogeneous, essentially what you're assuming is this big, flat, nice and smooth flow field where water is flowing through this block of rock towards from its recharge area to its discharge area. Whereas if you accept that this is a karst aquifer, what you realize is that there's conduits down here, and they may be in the form of fracture zones or horizons that can be identified by seismic analysis or tubes that divers swim through. But in essence, water is converging on those conduits. And then once it enters the conduits, it's flowing out to its spring discharge points. So what we really have is a heterogeneous distribution of anisotropic permeabilities. So it's a big mouthful to say that you got to find those conduits if you really want to be able to map where the groundwater is flowing. How we would go about doing that, just different types of models. You might see these described as well. Continuum model, this is the porous, total porous media assumption. Discrete model, this might be like a stochastic model that simulates fracture networks and then flow through these fracture networks. And then in the middle, you have hybrid models that try to put the two together. And really, I think that this is definitely where we are going and where we should be. It's particularly in Florida, these hybrid types of models. And the reason I'm telling you this is because the technology exists, so there's no reason to allow your state regulatory agencies to accept models that are done like this. That, you know, we talk about it in the back my partner Rich and I, we made a comment last night that all these problems would go away if we had really competent regulators and really thorough regulations. Because everybody would know what how to proceed through this complicated, environment. But instead, you get things that come through that should just be denied and instead are accepted. And because they're accepted, people are encouraged to do it that way again. So that's basically what it looks like, is we're going to try to model, we're going to be modeling discrete flow through some network of conduits that we put into a porous media solution. And what it allows us to do is we move from this to being able to model this. And what I'm going to kind of talk about is how we can, do that. Because one of the things that I run into all the time is, gosh, how is it possible that you could build a model like that if you don't know where those caves are? We have to go find, we have to parameterize the aquifer. You hear that thrown out there. We have to find all those caves. What's the magic tool that's going to allow us to find and map all those caves so that people can come back and build these models? And my answer to that is that there is no magic tool. And moreover, we don't even really need a magic tool, because we have the capability, from the $6 million man days. We have the technology. We can do it. We just have to think about it in the right way. And that's what I'm going to kind of be going to talk about, how we get to that world over there. And I'm going to do it by describing a model that we're building right now in the Santa Fe River Basin, actually for Coca-Cola, for a water bottling facility that they have at Jimmy Springs. And we can talk about the implications of that later, but the bottom line is that Coca-Cola approached us and they said, we want you to build a basin-scale groundwater model that looks at karst flow to the Santa Fe River and identifies all of the impacts in the basin. And then we want you to take that out and share it with the Suwannee River Water Management District so that we can all have a transparent way to move forward and operate in this basin. And for me, I looked at that and I said, that's a pretty nice mandate, and if I can do that, then that's a good deal. So we're working on this model with Coke, and we're in the process this year of trying to take it out to Suwannee River Water Management District, and it'll probably be out to USGS for review this year, at some point this year. But the point is that the Santa Fe River Basin is an unconfined Floridan aquifer. This is the confining layer here, that scarp of it, so come drops out here. This is Santa Fe. This is the Itchituckney. Anybody been to Itchituckney here? Lots of people, okay. So big springs. All these red dots are just like at Wakulla. These are swallets or sinking streams that receive water. So it's, you can see that it's a complicated karst setting. And what we're going to do is we're going to build a model that tries to honor everything that we know or can reasonably know or predict or estimate about the Santa Fe River Basin. And to do that, we built this really complicated looking flow chart of parameters that I'm not going to explain to you, but except just in general, is that what we do is change the way we think about groundwater modeling. And I'll say that models, what they really do is they produce predictions of groundwater levels. That's really all they do. They tell you where the water level is going to be in the aquifer. And from that, you get ability to estimate or predict everything else. You can predict the direction of groundwater flow. You can predict the velocities of groundwater flow. You can predict the movement of contaminants. You can do everything by just having a prediction of what those water levels are. So typically, models calibrate, or calibration is the process of matching what the model simulates to what you know to be true. So if you have a well and the water level is 10 feet right at my feet, I don't plug that in and make the model be at 10. I set the model up to do what I want it to do, and then I come back and I say, well, what do you think the water level is? And if it's 20, then I know I still have some work on the physics and the way I've set my model up. But if it's 10, then I feel more confident that the model's probably telling me something that's reasonable. The problem is that if you only calibrate these models to heads or to water levels, you're really missing a lot of the karst complexity that is in the karst aquifer. However, if you go in and you set the model up such that it is capable of telling you how much water comes out of these springs, and then you calibrate to those spring flows, and then if you set it up such that you know how much water is going in at swallets, and you calibrate to those inputs, and if you have information, say, from dye tracing that tells you how long it takes to go from one place to another, even if that's just on a linear line, you have multiple ways, more ways, more data points to which to calibrate your model. So if you think of it in terms of uncertainty, really what you have with just calibrating to hedge is a model that can tell you almost anything. The degrees of freedom are high. Whereas when you calibrate to all these other things, you shrink the degrees of freedom. The number of possibilities greatly reduces, and so you become more confident in your prediction. So what we do is you go into a basin and we identify, well, what's going to be our data? Data is basically our green places, in other words, things that we actually can measure or somebody has measured and we can get that. The pink ones are things that we have to, that we're going to calibrate to. So these are data streams that we're actually going to test our model against. And the yellow ones are things that we don't know anything about, and we therefore we have to estimate. And so these are what we might call calibration knobs, or things that you're going to change to get the result. So the idea would be, of course, to minimize the number of yellow blocks, maximize the number of pink blocks, and there you get, if you do, the more you do that, the less, or the more unique your model answer becomes. And we can do that. I think that it's not unreasonable to be able to do that. So these are all these sinking streams, and I'm just going to show you that all these things, what we do is we put those directly into the model. And another thing that we have as a weakness as scientists, I think we cross with engineers a little too much, in that we look at things and we say, well, there's no data to tell us what's going down at Mill Creek Sink. And so we just won't put it in because we don't have any data for that. Well, that's not smart. I mean, we can use our heads and think of what's reasonable. In other words, we can observe, we can measure what the catchment area for Mill Creek Sink is, and then we can get just basic estimates of how long that sink takes to drain after a big rainstorm. So by just some basic calculations, we can try to estimate the rate at which water moves through Mill Creek Sink. And by doing these types of calculations, we don't get we don't get the right number, but we get close to it. And that is the kind of information that we start to use as input parameters to try to get more data blocks, so to speak, get some constraint on the estimation blocks and building the model. So that's what we do. And the same thing, those are sinks, goes for springs. Unfortunately, and this will be a theme I come back to, there's really no data for these spring discharges, or very little. Suwannee River Water Management District collects like point-in-time data sets for a lot of the springs. Many of them don't have any data whatsoever. So again, you have to resort to estimates. You have to resort to looking for people that have done different kinds of estimates through time. Like, for instance, my colleague in the back, Rich, and I spent a whole summer doing research on the Santa Fe River, trying to estimate groundwater input to the stream using geochemical markers. So it doesn't give you an exact number, but it gives you an idea. So you can use that kind of information to constrain what is likely to be coming out at all these individual spring vents. And then by doing that, your groundwater model simulation becomes a lot tighter. So finally, what you do is you put all of that indirect data together, and you can compile that into a map of where you think these caves might exist. And what we do here is we look at, we're blessed in the Santa Fe River Basin with actually a pretty dense distribution of wells that give us water level data. So this is a plot of the potentiometric surface map of that basin. And this is the key, where we hand contoured it.
I'm sorry,
nope. I don't think we should let them steal our flag.
I think that's breaking the federal law.
I don't know. I just played that game, take the flag too many times as a kid. It just feels wrong to let them come in and take our flag out of the fight. But, going back to this, one of the problems that I tend to see is an over-reliance on computers. I'm a computer modeler, but we still do things by hand, believe it or not. We contour potentiometric surface maps by hand. Why is that important? Because if you were to plot, you see these bright areas, these yellow areas are highs, and the purple areas are lows. And so basically what you're seeing is a mound of groundwater, like mountains of groundwater here, that drain off and flow through these troughs or into these troughs of groundwater, which of course this is the Santa Fe River here, where all the water is discharging at those springs. So if we were to just plug this into a computer plotting program, what we would see is closed depressions around these individual wells that have the low data points. Well, there's no mechanism to explain a closed depression on a potentiometric surface map, but that doesn't stop me from reading them time and time again in reports that are submitted to the state, because a closed depression means that it goes away, that it goes into that hole, and so it would be a well. So if you have a well pulling water out of the ground, that's a closed depression in the water table. But if you don't have a well there, how can you possibly explain it? I guess it's like Percy that the water budget doesn't work for them. It just goes into a wormhole and comes out, you know, some other universe. Well, it doesn't. It's just that that's not a hole. It's probably a trough. And so by hand contouring this thing up, you get an idea of what the system looks like. And instead of reading all that stuff, I'll just pull it out. And the bottom line is that it starts to make sense, because what we see is troughs where there are mapped cave systems and troughs where there are traced pathways, in other words, where somebody, in this case Pete Button, Carson Environmental Services, did dye tracing experiments, and conveniently it plots right through this trough. They did other dye tracing experiments where it plots roughly through this trough, and so then you can start to make, let's see, if there are karst pathways through this trough and this trough and this trough, well, there's probably one through that trough too. So we'll put another conduit in here, and we'll put a conduit in here. We'll build a conduit network, and then we'll build our groundwater model. And if it doesn't calibrate, then we'll go back and we'll look at how we define those conduits, because that's one of those parameters. So what we'll do is I'll just show you how they compare, and then I'll try to wrap it up. Basically, here's a model that we made for Koch, and we wanted to show them what it would be like if you didn't go through all the trouble of trying to put the karst in there. This is what we get. This is the best calibration that we could produce. And you get kind of a general flow field that warps off towards the Santa Fe River. And here's what you get if you plug in the karst. And it may not look a whole lot different to you, but to us, it looks a lot different. And more importantly, what it shows in this case, there's the Newberry area. So you have Newberry's spray field, you have some quarries in this region. And if you look at this head field, you see that, well, this could be flowing off in this way, or it could be flowing over here, it could be flowing out there, but it's probably moving pretty slow. But here, it's right next to this big trough that's flowing out towards Toonie Springs. And from a model speak point of view, this one calibrates way, way better than this one calibrates. So the confidence in this prediction of anything, of contaminant transport times, of effects of groundwater pumping, of effects of dewatering, effects of injections, of effects of spray fields, anything, are going to be way more reliable in this way than they are in this way. So, does this matter? You know, again, this is where I talk about the corkscrew mine here. I think we've already had an introduction to it, but basically we were asked to, we didn't have a whole lot of data, but we were asked to just take a look at a mine's submitted model, which was done in accordance with all the little, fill-in-the-blank lines on the DEP report. And so, if you look at it in that context, there's, nothing wrong with what they did. And see how that, compared to, if you were to take a more robust way of looking at it, and how would perhaps, if there was potentially a karst conduit in there, how that could affect those results. In essence, what we saw is that there's cone of depression from this quarry, just like there would be from any dewatering event, which was different than what was done with the fill-in-the-blank lines. And that's really because when you look at it in the broader perspective, you get a different answer than when you look at it only on the postage stamp. And I think that goes back to the hole in the felt idea. So, and if we were to put a karst conduit in there, now we didn't have any information in this case at all to tell us where a karst conduit could be, but as an example, we just plugged one in. We said, okay, well, what happens if we had a conduit in here? Could we possibly calibrate this model if there's a karst conduit? And is it possible that there really is karst in Lee County, in other words? And what we found is yes, we could put a condo in here. We could produce a calibrated groundwater model. And ultimately, all it would do is change our idea of where the impacts, how those impacts, how that cone of depression is shaped, and where those impacts would be felt. That's really what it changed. It didn't change our ability to model it. It just changed our answer into where that impact was going to be felt and over what time period. So I'll skip through those results. This is the same type of thing for Hercules Quarry in Pennsylvania. This was a model that we did for them back in 2000. We didn't really have any data, and we didn't have much it was a preliminary study. It was the porous media type model. We get a cone of depression that looks like this. For reference, that's the quarry footprint right there. Here we came at 2007 and really looked at karst features, the relationship between the quarry and the stream. And here's the cone of depression, or here's the zone of influence. So, you know, that's the quarry outline there. So that is the same as this, and basically the same prediction here. You know, so it's a much bigger, different shaped prediction. Again, and actually in this case, it's a better calibrated groundwater model. But the problem, you know, another problem that we face, which people have brought up, and this is where I'm going to end in commenting, is that we're asked to say how the quarry, what's their zone of influence, what's their impact? Well, how can I tell anybody what the impact of the quarry is if I don't know what the conditions were like before the quarry existed? So we have to make up ways to try to hypothesize what it could have been like, in this case, over 100 years ago, because Hercules has been there for a really long time. But it occurs to me that that's a good excuse. You know, Hercules has been there for 100 years. Pretty good excuse for not knowing what it was like 100 years ago. What excuse do we have in Florida when the technology exists, the people capable of collecting the data exists, to tell us what it is like today? So 10 years from now, when somebody wants to know what the zone of influence is for a quarry, and you don't have the ability to tell them because you don't know what it was like today, we don't have an excuse for that. The only excuse that we have is that we didn't have the political will necessary to create that picture of what the world looks like today, so that tomorrow we can make those impact assessments. So really, in the summary, is that the quality of an impact assessment is heavily determined on the accuracy and the scale of the conceptual model to which they're based. Florida limestones are predominantly karst, and conceptual models need to be large enough to account for local and regional hydraulic features, recharge and discharge. In other words, the little post hole, you know, thing that everybody's complained about, it needs to end. You need to be doing characterization studies that put any activity, whether it's a spray field or a quarry or a well or, you know, whatever it is that is being done, in the context of where it fits in the groundwater basin or the surface water basin that it's likely to impact. Modeling can be an effective tool for that if and only if, you know, going back to that math thing, if and only if they're based on reasonably accurate conceptualizations. Otherwise, it doesn't really matter that you did a model. So my pitch is that what we need is basin-wide characterization models that are continuously updated as new data is collected. Another little story, all of those surface water features, the USGS is really good at measuring flows and streams. But yet they had to shut their surface water their surface water monitoring stations down in the Woodville Karst Plain because there was no budget for them. So they just say, oh, we don't need those. Just turn those off, all those little creeks. And now we find ourselves 10 years later in the place of having to go before the governor's panel and go before DEP and tell them that, no, there needs to be a budget because all those little streams are important, not because anybody really cares about what happens at Black Creek or Jump Creek. They don't right now, they probably will someday in the future, but those all impact Wakulla Springs. So you can't build a model, and I can't tell you what happens at Wakulla Springs without knowing what happens at Jump Creek. And so we need to be able to have the USGS out there measuring stream flows, measuring water levels, so that we can use that data to make our make assessments. We need to incorporate high-frequency data. That was the pitch of one of those studies that we saw. you know, you see quarterly groundwater sampling. Well, for $500, you can get a little in situ, you know, water level meter that you just throw in the well, and it'll take measurements every 15 minutes. You know, and then you come back months later and collect it, and you got this so much data you have to throw it away in order to be able to use it in a computer. But you have a tremendously different understanding of how the aquifer works. And so instead of, you know, a lot of times you'll see people argue that, well, what we need to do is go out this one point in time and measure the age of the groundwater. I'm like, well, those things cost thousands of dollars to get one sample run. Why don't we just go out and throw $500 in and get months worth of head data from many different places, and we can do a lot more with that first. And in my opinion, they should be politically or publicly available and transparent. So in other words, these characterization models on which everything is based, they need to be publicly available, they need to be fully transparent and described so that anybody, you know, a non-groundwater person that doesn't know anything about this can be able to read this report and in the end go, yeah, okay, I understand, they did a good job. You know, it's not like written in Hydro-E's or something that people can't understand. And I think they should be the required foundation for all local scale investigations and assessments. So, you know, and then when we do that, then we can start to look at mines and quarries and look at their consumptive use, the recharge, discharge, reclaimed use. We can look at it basically in terms of the water balance evolution. We can see, once we have those kind of characterizations, think of how much, you know, better it would be to be, how much more confidence you have when somebody then comes and says, well, based on this assessment, we think that this is the best place to put a quarry, or this is the best place to put a quarry, and this is how we're going to mitigate these impacts, you know, things like that. You have a better framework to understand these answers. And then, finally, let's skip over that part and touch, that's where rocks thrown at me. You jump to this last one, is, you know, is this a pipe dream? You know, and I don't think it is. I think that what we need to be looking at is, number one, I think that quite often we have our animosity is directed at the wrong people. Because in essence, you know, I find myself working for people that apply for, get permits to do resource related work, whether it's water or mining or whatever it is. And what do? They go to the state. They say, what is required of me? And they look at the things that are required, and then they hire a staff or a consultant, and they say, please go out and make sure that we comply with every environmental, every law that is out there so that we can do what we have to do. But if those laws are inadequate, then your gripe should be with the legislators and with the DEP for not doing their job to properly enforce environmental protection. You know, I say that, and I work, a lot of my budget comes from DEP, so hopefully there's nobody from DEP here. But it's the truth, and I think that most people at DEP would tell you the same thing. Right now, Florida's budget, we heard the budget shortfall. Well, Florida Geological Survey and Florida DEP, all funding for research was cut this year. So no spending on any of that this fiscal year. So basically our program in North Florida is going to come to a halt. And all of that idea about sampling streams and this and that and the other, it all boils down to political choice of where you're going to spend your money. And in the case of what my own experience is with Coke, I think there's potentially a lot to be gained by looking at corporations as a potential partner in those kind of things. So partially publicly funded, public-private partnerships to try to develop these big characterization studies into which they know they'll end up being regulated, but at least it'll give them a framework and they know what to do. So with that, anyway, I'm sure I went over.